Do you have financial goals for the new year? Financial planner Kevin McKinley may be able to help during this first On Your Money of 2017. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Kevin will also have some information and advice on paying off credit card bills, socially responsible investing, and avoiding food waste. And saving some money as you go along. He will also answer your questions and help you get started on your new financial goals for this new financial year at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Happy New Year, Kevin.
Hello, Joy, and Happy New Year to you, too, and everyone else out there.
I hope that you had a very happy holiday season, and I know that many of us are going to be paying off that happy holiday season pretty soon. Wisconsin residents, though, will likely be able to pay off our post-holiday credit card bills faster than the rest of America, you say, Kevin. How so?
Well, this was a study conducted by the website creditcards.com, and what they did is they took a state-by-state look of each resident's average credit card balances, a sampling, and compared it to the median earnings of the state to figure out how fast those state residents could pay off the credit card debt if they used 15% of their earnings towards the credit card debt each month.
And how did we do?
Actually, pretty well. Fifth best in the country. Our $4,700 average balance was able to be paid off with our median income in 14 months. North Dakota was the best. They were able to pay off their credit card balance on average of 12 months. Alaska was last. Took them 20 months to retire their credit card debt.
Huh, interesting. Is it in our water, you think? I don't know. So for those listeners who have some credit card debt, how should they go about prioritizing paying it off?
Well, you have to meet your basic monthly expenses first. Obviously, you've got to pay the rent or your mortgage payment, your utility bills, all that other stuff, and the minimum payments for the credit cards. Just first of all, try not to add to the balance if you can. Let's see if we can put the credit cards away for a while and just pay cash for things. If you don't have the cash on hand, you can't afford it for right now. And then try to accumulate 3 months' worth of expenses in savings, meaning if you have, let's say, $4,000 per month that you spend in a typical month, and not every month is the same, there are ups and downs, but let's say you typically come in at about $4,000. Try to get $12,000 set aside first before you pay off any credit cards whatsoever. And once you have that 3 months' worth of expenses set up, then use any extra money you have to pay off those credit cards and eliminate the balances.
What if we have several different credit card accounts? What's the best strategy to pay them off?
Are you asking just...
Just for a friend.
Right, out of in the hypothetical.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
On paper, you should, of course, pay the most towards the accounts that charge you the highest interest. But if you are having a difficult time finding the motivation and finding the money to do so, you can employ what's known as the snowball effect, which can be psychologically much easier to help retire this debt. And what that does is you prioritize all of your accounts, smallest to largest. And if you've got one credit card that has, say, $600 or $700 on the balance, and you've got another that's $1,500, then you've got another that's $5,000, pay off the small balance one first, because you'll feel better about it, you'll get more excited about it, and you'll get that extra savings from not making the payments on the smaller one that can be applied towards the next one. And this sounds kind of silly, but there was actually a study published recently that was conducted by two Texas A&M behavioral economists, and it was published in the Journal of Marketing Research, and they found that people who attacked a big insurmountable task in small bits first and had very small, relatively meaningless accomplishments right away compared to the big picture, they're actually able to get through the task faster and enjoyed it more rather than if they looked at it from some giant thing and said, oh, I'm going to start, let's say, paying off my credit cards. I got a $10,000 balance on one of these. I'm going to put $500 towards that. Well, the next month, after the interest is calculated, it might be knocked down maybe to $9,750, which is, in our minds, pretty close to $10,000. Therefore, it doesn't feel as good to us as if we had completely retired one much smaller account.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. Now, that being said, what are your personal finance questions? Do you need some help in starting 2017 off on a firm financial foot? 1-800-642-1234. We have an open line for you. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Maybe you have some personal finance goals. I'm sure Kevin can help you at least get started on them. Here's an email from Andy who writes, I have been listening to your show on WPR for a while now, and I want to say you do a good job. Actually, he said great job, so that's very nice. Thank you, Andy. I donated during the campaign to get a copy of the On Your Money booklet for millennials and passed it along to my son and daughter. It's something I wish my parents had done for me to stress the importance of saving for retirement. My 24-year-old daughter says she is now part of an aggressive growth Roth IRA.
Wow.
Yeah, that's
well, cool. That's very nice. Thank you very much, Andy. It's good to start the new year off with some false praise and an anecdote even to back it up. So thank you very much.
Yeah, and he does have a question about that he wanted to add here. My wife and I went to a seminar where we learned about fixed index annuities. To me, it sounds a little too good to be true. Do you know of any downsides to them? We were told that we may not make anything in some years when the market drops, and we won't actually lose anything. Do you have any advice or any thoughts on either pro or con on fixed index annuities? We won't be touching any of the money that we are putting into this until retirement. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, that perception is actually relatively close to the reality with a few catches. And what happens is you do invest your money into an annuity provided by an insurance company. And the insurance company takes it and invests it and then also buys kind of their own little insurance. It's kind of a hedging strategy to try to make sure that the account doesn't go down a lot when the stock market declines. And for the cost of that, it means it doesn't go up a bunch when the stock market rises a lot. You'll have little or no gain in bad years for the stock market, but you'll have some gain in good years. Again, although it is capped.
Yeah, so that doesn't sound so bad so far. What's the issue?
Yeah, and that's usually the sales pitch, which ignores or downplays a lot of the negatives. First of all, you're looking at a huge commission payout on these particular products. Oftentimes, the salespeople who sell these get 6% or more on the amount that you put in. So if you put in $100,000, the salespeople and his or her employer get $6,000 of that money. And you wonder where that comes from because, you know, it's not technically coming out of your account. Well, it comes from the annual expenses that are billed to that account every single year that help reduce your rate of return every single year. It's kind of like the insurance company borrows the money to pay off the commissions and then dings you to make the payments on the loan that they took to pay off the commission for it. So you're going to lose money from the overall gross performance every single year just for the very high expenses. And then there are surrender charges to make sure you stay in this thing long enough so that they can bleed the money out to pay off the commissions and the other expenses. The surrender charge might be anywhere from 5 to 10%, and it might last anywhere from 5 to 10, and I've even seen some of these that have lasted for 15 years. So if there's a 5% surrender charge and you put $100,000 in and you pull it out, you actually only get $95,000 back, plus or minus whatever money you've made or lost in the meantime.
Yeah. So besides these fees, are there any other disadvantages?
One of the big problems I have with annuities and how they're sold is a lot of times they are sold based on, you know, seminars that happen where you get a free lunch or breakfast or dinner, and then there's a big sales pitch for this, and they talk about a lot of the great things about the annuities. They don't talk about a lot of the negatives, such as the expenses of it. There are huge prospectuses that come along with these products that the buyer has to read and understand, and nobody reads them and nobody understands them, and they're 200-300 pages long, so that's understandable. Also, the terms can be changed on these. Some insurance companies retain the right to say, hey, if things don't go very well, we may not be able to honor this obligation we promised you because we weren't able to make enough money on this to meet our obligation to you. And in a crisis, the insurance company might not even have the ability to honor what they've told you that they're going to be able to pay you in good years or bad years or whatever. And then the money can get turned over to a state agency, and there are all kinds of problems with that as well.
Yeah. So do you think Andy and his wife should consider these fixed index annuities or not?
Maybe. And only for maybe a portion of their assets. If they understand the costs, the risks, and the terms, and that they feel like they're dealing with someone who's really giving them the basics in this in a way that they understand both the positives and the negatives, not just upselling all of the benefits without highlighting the negatives as well. Otherwise, if they're looking for an alternative, they may want to go with just a simple 50-50 portfolio where they take half of their money and put it in CDs, which aren't going to make very much money but aren't going to lose money, and then the other half in a low-cost index fund like Vanguard or something like that. They're going to have much lower expenses, and they're going to have more flexibility because they can choose to do what they want to do with the money regardless of what's going on with the markets. Now, it may mean that they don't make as much in good times on the CDs, but they won't lose as much on the stocks because half of their portfolio won't budge.
Let's take a call from Ann in Milwaukee now. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good morning. I'm really excited to be on, so thank you. I am 30, and my husband is 33. We got our career started a little bit later in life, and we own a house. We have one car payment, but we have no credit card debt whatsoever, which we're somewhat proud of. But we do have some school debt, and at this point, we're just not quite sure how to tackle it. I actually received a wonderful scholarship to go to university, but it was still very expensive. And then, unfortunately, I actually had to have heart surgery in college. So at this point, after getting my master's, I actually have about 100 grad in school debt, and my husband has about 20. He also has his master's. We're bringing in about 100 grand a year with our salaries, but we just aren't quite sure how to tackle our school debt. I actually had been working in a nonprofit for several years and was on a loan forgiveness program, and life just kind of took a wonderful change, and I'm not in nonprofit anymore. I have a great career, but now my payments, you know, under that nonprofit or under that loan forgiveness were about $250 a month, and they're going up to $800. Which, you know, it's fine. We can definitely afford it. But I'm just wondering, you know, if there's other options out there, if we should consolidate both of our debts. You know, we're looking at about $120,000 in, you know, school debt. And we're just not quite sure how to start tackling it.
Well, and do the rest of the listeners a favor here and vouch for the fact that when you were in college or maybe even in high school, if I would have told you that in your 30s that you would be making $100,000 a year, you would probably have said, I don't even know what we'll do with all that money.
And we say that now. Like, we feel like we're rich. So, you know, we're not, you know, naive to the fact that we're very blessed in everything that we have. We're just trying to figure out the best way to approach it. So, yes, yep. I would agree with you.
Okay, yeah, and that's something that all of us have gone through. As just for young people out there, you get this shock that, you know, you hopefully make more and more money as you get older and hopefully become more valuable in the workplace and get better jobs or get promoted or whatever. And every time you make a little bit more money, it never seems like it's quite enough. But good for you. And I'm glad to hear about your perspective and that you have a lot of gratitude, which is something that many of us don't have enough of. And so that's nice to hear and a good way to start the new year. And do you have a rough idea of what the interest rates are on these loans on average?
Yeah, so mine is about 6%. Mm-hmm. When I started the loan forgiveness, I did have to consolidate most of them. So I have some subsidized and some unsubsidized.
Okay. All right. And your husband's about the same?
His is a little bit lower than mine, but yeah, pretty close.
Okay. The bad news about loans in general, and especially student loans, is that it's not the interest, it's the principal. You know, even if you said, well, we have to pay $1,000 a month on these loans, it's still going to take, even if it were 0% interest, you'd still take 10 years to have to repay these balances off if you paid $1,000 a month. And so the interest certainly doesn't help, but that's not the problem here. It's more about saying what to do to attack it. And I would tell you that I would not... I wouldn't be a huge proponent of paying it all off with every extra bit of cash you have. It might feel good to do it, but you might also be sacrificing other things. So what I'd rather have you do is, first of all, if you get, you know, make the minimum payments, obviously, but then also get that 3 months worth of living expenses set aside as well. And then finally, if you are in this higher tax bracket of making $100,000 gross per year, you're probably about $10,000 in income above the top of the 15% federal income tax bracket. So I'd like to see you at least set aside $5,000 to $10,000 per year for your own retirement. And if you can do that in a pre-tax plan like a 401k or a 403b or an IRA, do that. And then and only then would I start attacking the principal for it. And I do it in the same way that we just talked about with the credit cards, what they call the snowball effect of starting to, with the smaller loans first, pay that one off, and especially since your interest rates are pretty similar across the board. Pay the smallest one off. That might be your husband's loans. But then start building that up, and it will feel good to do it. You've already gone through the consolidation part of it, so there's not much benefit to here. You can look at refinancing some of these loans in some cases, but I don't think you're going to end up saving a lot of money, especially many of those refinancing programs, as you probably know, Ann, actually put in substantial fees up front. So if you are paying it off at a pretty good clip, which I really think you are, it means that the fees that you pay don't offset the lower, or they don't help offset the lower interest cases. So you end up paying more in fees than you would save in interest by going down. But otherwise, no. Keep doing what you're doing. There's no magic trick to it. It's the principal, not the interest.
Thanks for the call, and good luck to you. If you have a question for Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
If I had a million dollars,
well, I'd buy you a house.
I would buy you a house.
Are you in the market for a house in 2017? How about a car? How about more retirement investing? We are talking about our financial goals for 2017 during this first On Your Money of the year. We're welcoming your questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our next caller is Diana in Janesville. Hi, Diana.
Hi. I'm so thrilled to be talking to you today. Actually, mine is not a 2017 goal. It's a 2016 goal that I never got around to.
Well,
I'm old. I'm going to die one of these days, so I need to have a will, and I'm not exactly sure what it is I need and how to go about getting that.
Well, Diana, I appreciate your pragmatism, and you cleverly haven't died yet without a will. So, good job!
Yay!
I think that's a good move on your part. Yeah, wills and other kinds of estate plans are necessary for just about everyone, especially if you are an adult, if you have any assets, or if you have anyone who is relying on your income or your assets, and that can be a partner or spouse, it can be a child, it can be a parent, it can be a pet. There are lots of different reasons that you should want to pursue estate planning. So I would, do you have any of those things, Diana?
I have two kids, but they don't really need anything from me. I just want to make sure they don't have problems once
okay.
I'm gone with, you know, getting everything all taken care of and whatever. And I don't have a lot of assets.
Yeah, okay, but that's actually a great reason to look at this, is because those of us who have had to serve as executors for loved ones or friends in the past know that one of the greatest gifts you can give to your survivors is to plan for things in advance, so that if you do pass away, especially if it's unexpectedly, things are already there in place so that they don't have to do a lot of the extra work to try to tidy everything up. So have you ever been to a lawyer or an attorney, Diana, to have this kind of work done?
No.
Okay. You can go to a website called AVVO.com, AVVO.com, and you can search for estate planning attorneys in your area. And I'd prefer that you focus on an estate planning attorney rather than just a friend who's a lawyer, because sometimes there can be little wrinkles, and everyone says, well, I have a very simple situation, but, oh, by the way, I was married and my husband still is paying, my ex-husband is still paying some survivorship, something like that. So everybody has some kind of little wrinkle now, or they will have one in the future. And so it's good to have a qualified estate planning attorney around to address those issues with you. Go in, tell that person your situation, ask that person what it's going to cost to get things done the way that they should be done. And by the way, there's a legal structure of how things should be done, but there's also the way you want them to be done. And the attorney's job is to kind of make those two different needs be met. Have you get done what you want to get done and the way you want it to be handled, but then also make sure that it's legally enforceable. So go to AVVO.com, and estate planning attorneys, like all attorneys, rely on our ignorance for their living. If we knew how to do everything that they know how to do, they wouldn't have jobs. So don't feel bad if you don't know what you're doing or you don't even know what questions to ask. They'll ask the questions for you. And again, it's very acceptable to ask what it's going to cost, to say, okay, is the first hour free, the consultation? If it is, great. After the end of the hour, will you be able to tell me about how much it's going to cost? And typically in a situation like yours, sounds like, Diana, you're probably looking somewhere in the $500 to $1,000 range. And that might sound like a lot of money, but it is probably less than your kids would have to spend if you don't do anything at all.
So this isn't something I can go online and get a form and fill it out and do?
Yeah, you actually can. Wisconsin is one of the states which allows what's known as a holographic will. That means a handwritten will that is, I believe, has to be witnessed and signed by two disinterested parties. So that, in other words, if your kids are inheriting the money, they can't sign off on it. But you're still going to end up paying for that somewhere between $50 and $150. And as part of that will, you also should have proper beneficiary designations. You should set up any powers of attorney for health care, or what's known as a durable power of attorney, which can help, you know, manage your checking account if you are alive but not able to handle it. So it's more than just a piece of paper. And so it's certainly possible to do it yourself, and you can go online. A place like NOLO.com, N-O-L-O.com, has forms that they will sell you that technically are enforceable wills. But my preference is you'd invest a little bit more time and money and then make sure it's done properly.
Okay, sounds great. Thank
you. All right, thank you very much, Diana. Kevin, just generally, should everybody who's an adult have a will, or when should you make sure you have a will?
Yeah, I think that most people who have any kind of assets or even a lot of debts, you know, if you have debts that are difficult to discharge in bankruptcy or by death, sometimes student loans, that could be the case, or if you have a house, you have a car loan, it just makes it so much easier for the other people if you've taken those measures to put your wishes in place so that they know what you wanted and it's legally enforceable. And it's not just about when you die. It's about if you are alive, but you're incapacitated. And that could be something as you know, tragic as being in a car accident and you're unconscious. It could also be you're just, you know, you got surgery and you're out of commission for a few days or a few weeks. You want to have something in place so that the law already recognizes who you wanted to handle these things when you weren't able to.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. We are welcoming your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Here's an email from Paul in Eau Claire. He writes, I have about $8,000 left on my student loan and about 2 months of expenses in savings. I have no other unsecured debt, such as a credit card. But he goes on, should I keep saving to get 3 months while paying the minimum on this student loan, or should I just pay off the loan? And Paul adds that On Your Money is his favorite WPR show, bar none. So thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much, Paul. Sneaking in the false praise right at the end, yep, to make sure he gets on the air. Paul, great job so far. Getting that $6,000 balance down to the student loan, again, that's about one-fifth of the amount that's currently owed by graduates of four-year colleges who have debt when they get out of school, and about two-thirds of graduates have that debt. So good for you. And the fact that you don't have any other unsecured debt is great. I'd love you to get to that 3 months. And the reason being is that that's about the average time that people who lose their jobs are out of work before they find the new job. And so having 3 months will allow you to still pay your bills and also survive while you look for a new job and not just have to take just any job, which when you have to take just any job, that means that you're working now 40 hours a week, and you don't have time to look for a better job usually. And so I'd rather have you have that time money and the cushion that the 3 months provides you, and especially when it comes to student loans. Because with student loans, if you pay it off, you can't go back and borrow from the student loan lender. You can't get that money back. At least with credit card debt, you know, if you do pay it back, you can charge up with the credit card again, assuming you have the limit available for it. So yeah, try to get to 3 months, and then once you get there, you're free to go ahead and whittle down the rest of that debt. And I'm guessing you'll get to both of those things pretty quickly.
Let's take a call from Jamie now in Eagle River. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I love your show. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. And I understand you have a question about the emergency fund.
I do. My question is, I've heard varying numbers in terms of months, 3 months, 6 months, sometimes even 12 months. Also, you know, you say 3 months. Does that include, you know, like, I've heard other planners say you should have a fund for your emergency house repair or emergency medical, and that sort of, and have an account for each of those different components of your budget. What do you, is that 3 months include all of that, Kevin?
Yeah, Jamie, thanks for your kind words. The 3 months is the basic. That's the beginning. That's a minimum of what you should really have before you do just about anything else with your money other than meet your basic monthly expenses like your rent, your mortgage, car payment, loan payments, what have you. The 3 months is the basic. And then if you say, I want to expand this off because I want to make sure that all these different things are covered, so I'm going to compartmentalize all these future expenses so that I'm socking some aside for each place. And I think the reason people do that is not because it's financially smarter to do it. It emotionally feels better when something bad happens that we don't want to happen, but we know it can happen, but we don't want it to happen, and it's not fun. It's not bad when it's not fun when the, you know, the roof needs to be replaced. But if you've already accumulated, say, $10,000 in some kind of account for that, it doesn't feel nearly as bad if you say, oh gosh, where is that money going to come from? And it helps us deal with these setbacks that all of us go through to some degree or another. If we already have money designated towards that issue. Actually, and in my case, I almost get excited about it. When one of those things happens, I say, oh, good. I knew this was going to happen sooner or later. That's why we set the money aside for this particular need. Therefore, not only will we pay this off and not have to deal with it, but it won't be an issue for us now, hopefully for a long time, so we can start accumulating more money in that slot. So get the 3 months down as a basic, and then if you want to start splitting that up above and beyond the 3 months and say, okay, my next dollars are going to go towards you know, my car, or it's going to go towards a medical deductible, or it's going to go towards saving for college. That's fine, but the 3 months is the basic one to start with.
Thanks, Jamie, for the call. Good luck to you. It's time now for Smart Assets. Investing your money alongside your morals is becoming more popular, and it's even more possible than ever before. There are, though, some pitfalls to consider. Kevin, where would you like to start with this one?
It's called socially responsible investing. There are lots of different names for it. Other terms include ESG, which stands for environmental, social, and governance. But it basically means screening your investments or putting money in a mutual fund that screens for environmental products, different things that the companies sell, like alcohol, firearms, if you want to avoid companies that produce those products, how companies treat their employees in terms of benefits and wages, the executive pay, or do they feel that the executives are overly compensated for their worth? And it could even be things like religious beliefs. It could be political. Whatever you feel in terms of how you'd like your money invested. Now, it's had a huge growth in the past few years. In 1995 in the U.S., there was about $639 billion invested according to these kinds of strategies. And right now, it's about $7 trillion. And so there's more money going towards this type of investing. There are more options for it. And it's a very deep subject, and I know it matters to a lot of our listeners. So we're going to be spending the next few weeks talking about this in more depth.
Good. I'm glad. I mean, it is certainly a lot of people want to invest with their conscience, but Does that mean that that we're going to sacrifice performance because of that?
Not necessarily. You know, it's hard to compare some of these funds from apples and apples to one fund to another at any given time, and especially when one is basically excluding several different companies which might be on paper financially profitable and viable, but might not be doing the work that the people investing the money want them to do. But there was a study put on by the Harvard Business School a few years ago, and they found that in the companies anyway that they monitored, they didn't do mutual funds, but they did companies, and they found that companies that adhered to certain loftier goals did as well or better financially than ones that didn't make any type of screening criteria part of their mission. In my mind, it does come down to a bit of a chicken and egg question. Do ethical companies make more money because they're ethical, or do profitable companies have the luxury of acting more ethically or adhering to higher standards than a company that's not doing as well?
And so are there other considerations when you're looking into socially responsible investing?
Yeah, one of the things that you want to consider is the lack of diversification. Of all the mutual funds out there, only about 1 to 2% of those funds have any type of social screening formula in place. And the ones that do, most of them focus on larger United States companies, which can be a good thing. Those companies have generally done well and better than others over the last several years. But it does mean you're going to have a less diversified portfolio because it's harder to find funds that invest in smaller companies or overseas or in bonds. And then also, you mentioned this before, Joy, the cost of these kinds of funds. Some of these mutual fund companies who put these in place did this with altruistic goals. They wanted to provide a service to investors looking for a specific kind of investing. Others did it because they thought, hey, we can make more money by putting particular funds like this out, and yeah, we'll adhere to some goals, but we're going to make more money off it, so let's charge more money in it as well. And there's some truth and some reason that there are higher expenses in place than a non-socially responsible fund, because it is more work for the firms, they have to work harder screening the companies out, etc. The good news is, though, the cost to these types of funds, like almost all mutual funds, are falling, and the expenses for these funds are getting much closer in line to index funds, and in fact, Vanguard, the leading index fund provider in the world, actually has a couple different socially screened options, so you still can get in on a low-cost basis.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley during this first On Your Money of 2017. When we come back, we're going to talk about how to avoid wasting food, and we'll take more of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me, you better shop around. You better shop around.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine talking with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and we're going to shop around a little more wisely so we don't waste food. And we are going to welcome more of your questions too at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. The new year is typically time for New Year's resolutions, and they often involve two main areas. And what are those two areas, Kevin?
It revolves around eating better and spending less. And so we are going to spend the next few weeks talking about how you can eat better or eat less or eat healthier, and by still spending the same money and hopefully less than you were spending last year.
And I already gave it away that we're going to talk about how we can avoid food waste. Why do you want to start there?
Well, because it's a big thing that I don't think that many of us pay attention to. You know, a lot of us try to, when we are trying to eat better, we try to buy whole foods with a lowercase w, real foods, which tend to be more expensive and also tend to spoil faster than packed and processed foods. And so then they get thrown out, or we put it in the leftovers and we freeze it and then we throw it out as well. And the NRDC says that Americans waste about $1 worth of food per day per person. So For a family of four, that's about $1,500 per year. Plus, when you dispose of food that is perishable, it releases methane. And methane is much worse for the environment than any of the carbon emissions that we're worried about, too. And we spend lots of time thinking about shopping for food, pricing it, coupons, weighing it out, which one's more, which one's worth. But we don't think about how much money that we're wasting, and it could be as high as 25% of our food bill.
So I feel guilty about this. I do this way too much. What are some ways, good ways, to avoid wasting food?
Start before you even go to the store and adopt what I call the Steve Jobs philosophy that he had about clothing, and put it towards your food. He quoted a study that talked about decision fatigue, which means if you have to make a decision every single day or several times a day about very mundane things, it takes away your energy and your ability to make better decisions for more important items. And that's why he wore, you know, black turtleneck and jeans and sneakers all the time, because he didn't have to think about what was clean, what matched, what looked good, what was appropriate. He just wore the same thing every single day. And I would have you plan your eating each week the same way. You know, a lot of us who were growing up, we had, you know, different nights of the week were different kinds of food. Like Tuesday was pork chop night. And there was a reason for that. It was so that, you know, typically the mom knew what was going to be expected of the family, knew how to prepare that particular dish, knew that it would be relatively well received by the people, and it would be eaten, and there wouldn't be a lot thrown away. So if you can kind of get in a schedule, so you say, okay, we're going to try to have hopefully the same thing every single night for a different variation. And then for breakfast and lunch, maybe have the same thing, you know, have a bowl of cereal every single day, or have eggs every single day, so that you don't have to think about it, and you don't have to waste things because you bought something that sounded good on one day, but then you never ate it in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. That's my. I want to buy all these, you know, fresh vegetables and make great salads and you know, eat healthy, and then I buy way too much. So,
farmers markets are basically predicated on that entire notion. Yeah.
So, how do I avoid that?
Well, once you're at the store, try to buy a little less, especially if it is something perishable. You know, rather than buying a big bag of spinach, buy a half a bag of it, or rather than buying a dozen apples, buy a half dozen, especially if you're not quite sure if you're going to be able to eat all them. And that is good. You know, they talk a lot about shopping around the perimeter of the store. That's the healthiest place to eat. And that's true. But again, the perimeter of the store are the things that are generally perishable. And so you have to be more careful with that. If you are buying vegetables, and especially if it's vegetables you're cooking, go with canned vegetables or frozen ones. They're usually much less expensive than the fresh versions. Obviously much easier to store and use when you need it rather than within the next few days. And they're just as nutritious in many cases. And in some cases, they're even cleaner because the process of getting them from the ground to you is cleaner than something that's fresh.
Yeah. And so then what do you do when you get home?
Start documenting this process for a while so that you can identify where you're wasting food. Write down everything, label everything that's going into the freezer or the fridge, put a little sheet of paper in the refrigerator so you don't have to look in it and then stare at the fridge and waste a bunch of energy trying to see what's in there to eat. Put a list on there of things that you want to get eaten quickly so it's not, you know, it's not out and perishing, but it's also in front of you so you know is in there and what should be used regularly. You might want to even put a piece of paper by the garbage or the recycling or the compost and write down everything that's going in there so you can see what's showing up on a regular basis and maybe know that you're not supposed to spend as much. And if you really need an easy way to do it, take your grocery receipt and tape that up on the cupboard door right next to the garbage and then mark a check next to the things that you bought that you're throwing away. And after a few weeks of doing that, you'll have a database so that you could say, I've been checking off carrots that I haven't eaten every time. Therefore, I'm not going to buy any carrots or I'm not going to buy as many. And then there's a neat website out. You know, you've heard a lot about how the USDA and other organizations are trying to convince us, rightfully so, that sell-by dates or use-by dates are not necessarily be-all, end-all of when a product is still good. And so just because something says sell-by doesn't mean if that date is passed that it's not still good to eat. They even have a website now called askkaren.gov, that you can go type in and have a live chat with. I'm pretty sure it's somebody not named Karen, but it's an expert who you can ask your food questions about such things as storage, cooking, spoiling, when can I use by, and they have a database of answers in there. But you can also, during weekday business hours, have a live chat with someone and ask them if your eggs are still good.
Yeah. And you know what? Sometimes one of the things that I will do is when I see that I have a whole boatload of vegetables that are just going to go to waste if I don't use them, or anything else for that matter, I, you know, make a big pot of soup or you know, throw them all in a quiche, and at least they won't go
to
waste.
Do something with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, the soup is great because even if you can't eat it right there, it's very easy to throw it into a Ziploc bag in individual servings, put it in the freezer, pull it out, microwave it, and it's perfectly safe, and it tastes really good, and it's good for you, and it's very easy to prepare.
Yeah. Personally, Kevin, do you get bored having pork chops every Tuesday? Or
No. One of my, a guy I was really good friends with, we used to go out for lunch a lot, and he and his wife and Rachel and I went out for dinner one time, and he turned to Rachel and he said, do you know he orders the same thing for every single time we go out to eat, and he eats the same thing for breakfast every single day? And she said, well, that's one of the reasons I married him. I want him to just expect the same thing and like it and appreciate it rather than always want something new.
If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, there is still time for you. We do have an open line. If you have a money management question or a financial goal that you want to run by Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Or you can post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Dory emails, greetings, I love your show. Thank you, Dory. Can you please talk a bit about long-term care insurance? My hubby and I, who are both 56, are thinking about buying some, but I'm nervous about the cost. I think, Kevin, we've talked about this before. What advice do you have for Dory?
Yeah, we've talked about it before. We will be talking about it again, especially because a lot of people who kind of have, you know, the basics covered financially, and if they're looking at retirement, that's a big concern out there. And especially when it's people who have gone through a long-term care situation for a loved one, usually a parent, where the mother or father had to go to a nursing home and had to stay there for a long time. And not only was it a terrible situation emotionally and medically, but financially it may have exhausted that person's savings, and it becomes difficult to pay for it. Now, generally, people don't get kicked out in the street if they can't pay for nursing home care, but it is something that people are rightfully concerned about. When it comes to long-term care, and we're going to be doing a segment on this in a few weeks, but long-term care should basically be considered by people who have at least $200,000 in liquid assets, but less than $2 million in liquid assets. If you have less than that, you probably can't afford the premiums. If you have more than that, it's probably a better idea to self-insure, meaning just pay for it out of savings. And the same goes if you maybe don't have that much in assets, but you have a large pension payment come in that, you know, maybe several thousand dollars a month. If your pension and Social Security is close to $5,000 a month, you probably don't need long-term care insurance, because that amount should cover most of what you would need for long-term care. But for everybody else, I definitely recommend you look at it. But here's what you're going to find. You're going to find that it's very expensive. In your 50s, it can be $200 to $300 per month, and it could be more than that if you're in your 60s or your 70s. And there's no real certain guarantee that you're going to pay into this policy for 25 or 30 years and that the insurance company is going to be around and able to pay it off. And that doesn't mean the insurance company is stealing the money or doing something wrong with it. It's just, it's very difficult for them to know who is going to keep the policy, who's going to need it, and how much that cost is going to be. And in the meantime, how to invest it conservatively and get the rate of return the insurance company needs so that they can price the premiums attractively, but still make sure there's enough to pay off the people who have done it. And again, we'll explain more about this in a few weeks, but those are the benchmarks I'd use to start out. And for people who say, you know, I really think we need this, but it's driving me nuts how expensive it is, you might be better off, especially if you're in your 50s, putting aside $300 or $400 per month and in putting it in some type of savings account and just building it up over time, and at least that money will be there if and when you need it.
All right. Thanks, Dory, for the question. Jess on Facebook writes, I have $115,000 in a 457 plan. that I have not touched since I left that business. What would be the estimated tax burden on that money if I withdrew it? And is that tax burden less if I wait until I'm 62 or 65? Is there a way to move that into my current IRA and save some of the tax burden? Just has lots of questions there.
Yeah, but they're good questions, and ones that just about everybody in their in their 40s and 50s go through it when they have this type of plan. You don't want to take all that money out at once. And the reason being is that when you do, it will be taxed as ordinary income. For instance, even if you're not working, if you take $115,000 out of a 457 plan or a 403B or a 401K, the government will treat you like you made $115,000 and tax you accordingly. So you'll lose probably about a quarter to a third of that money in taxes right away, especially versus if you were to pull it out slowly, take a little bit about every single year. And of course, in some retirement plans and for most reasons, they'll hit you with a 10% penalty if you pull it out before 59 and a half. You can leave it there in many cases, but you can also roll it over to an IRA. And if you roll it over to an IRA and you do it properly, there'll be no taxes on that transfer whatsoever. As long as you don't take actual possession of the money in a spendable checking account, there aren't any taxes for it and there won't be any penalties for it. But you either need to be really good at doing this type of thing or you need to find somebody else who can do it. And usually the new IRA custodian, whether it's a bank, a credit union, a financial services company, an insurance company, a mutual fund company, what have you, they are really good at it. And they are responsible for the paperwork for making sure that it's rolled over appropriately.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jess. Karen in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I understand you want to take over Kevin McKinley's job?
Yes, I love his advice, and I am nearing the age of retirement, maybe 10 more years or so, and all of this 401k and withdrawal and everything is confusing to everyone. So I want to become a certified retirement specialist. There's a course through SEEDS that I'm looking at. It's a week-long course, and it's been highly recommended to become a certified retirement specialist. But I'm looking at other courses. So I was wondering if he has any recommendations.
Yeah, I think this is a case where a lot of people listening think, God, if this guy can do this, how hard can it be?
Very hard.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. And I've done it this is my 29th year of doing it, so I'm starting to get the hang of it. Karen, I'd highly recommend it. There are lots of people who do this, but there's not enough. And there are not enough good ones out there. And the good ones out there are usually pretty booked up and pretty expensive. And so the more people doing this, hopefully the better advice will be, and hopefully the lower the cost will be and the more people can get served. So I definitely recommend you do this. Karen, do you work in the financial services business right now?
I do.
Okay, good. So you have some understanding of what it takes in terms of the regulations, et cetera, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
I have a paralegal degree as well, so.
I'm sorry, what kind of degree?
I have a paralegal degree.
Oh, yeah. And actually, I know a little bit about that field. If you said, how hard is it to get at least the training that you need, you know, the technical training to do this, I would have to kind of put it online with being a paralegal. I don't think it's as hard technically as being, you know, a lawyer going through law school. Definitely not as hard as going through med school or nursing. Probably not as hard as being a CPA. You do have to know a little about a lot, so that's good. But no, I would definitely recommend you do this. I think that for people who are starting out anyway, a good thing to look at is getting the Certified Financial Planner designation. That's something that not only gives you a lot of knowledge, but helps signal to people that you do know what you're talking about. If you don't have a lot of experience, at least you can say, well, I do have some training in it. So that's something I would look at as well. In terms of the little courses, I'm not sure how much value those provide in terms of presenting yourself to the public as an expert. They might give you some good background and some knowledge so that you can help people, but I'm not sure that they do a lot in terms of doing it because there's so many different designations out there of certified retirement specialist, certified senior specialist. Some of these things provide really great training. Others are just ways to take your money and let you throw a couple letters up after your name. So the CFP is obviously the big one and the one that I would focus on, but it's a big investment in time. And you generally have to have some kind of tangible relationship with some firm that's actually doing financial planning to get that.
Karen, thanks for the call. Good luck to you. Barely time for the website of the week, Kevin.
Yeah, we were talking about making sure that you don't waste food. Well, there's a great book called The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook by Dana Gunders, and she came up with a fantastic website called SaveTheFood.com that will tell you how you can avoid wasting food and helping the environment, saving money, and eating better. SaveTheFood.com, and we'll have that website at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
Four more words before we go?
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.